This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Good morning, listeners. This is Beth Brann, and I'm delighted that you're joining us for the front page of the New York Times today. Our first article is titled Decisions Under Fire. Campuses try a mix of tactics as protests grow. Some colleges that initiated police crackdowns on pro-Palestinian protests have since taken a different tack. Others have defended the move. Hundreds have been arrested. Wearing riot helmets and carrying zip ties, Boston police officers moved in one day this week and surrounded a group of pro-Palestinian protesters on a grassy patch of Northeastern University's campus. Six police wagons were idling nearby, and an officer had issued a terse warning. Mass arrests looked imminent. Then, without explanation, the riot police packed up and left. The sudden end to the standoff produced cheers from the protesters and confusion for those who had been bracing for chaos. In recent days, police officers have rushed in to break up student encampments at the University of Southern California, Arizona State University, Ohio State University, and other colleges. At Emory University in Atlanta, officers used pepper balls and wrestled protesters to the ground, ultimately arresting 28 people. On quads and lawns from coast to coast, colleges are grappling with a groundswell of student activism over Israel's ongoing military campaign in Gaza. Administrators are having to make controversial decisions over whether to call in the police and are often criticized regardless of the route they take. "They don't seem to have a clear strategy," said Jenny Stevens, a professor at Northeastern who attended the protest there to support the students. "I think there's this inclination to kind of control what's happening on campus, but then that's balanced with the optics, or the violence, or the real harm done to students or faculty or staff or others if there are arrests." Hundreds of protesters have been arrested across the country. Police and protesters have reported being injured at some college demonstrations, but in many cases, the arrests have been peaceful, and protesters have often willingly given themselves up when officers move in. At Northeastern on Thursday, about 100 protesters had linked arms in a circle around a half dozen tents on a lawn known as the Centennial Common. The dean of students and the university police had warned protesters that they would be considered trespassers if they did not produce a student ID. The dean then went around the circle asking students for the cards. Some showed them, but many did not. A university spokeswoman, Renata Nayul, said in an email that the Boston Police Department had ultimately made the decision for its officers to leave without making arrests. Then, around dawn on Saturday, Massachusetts state police officers arrived and began to arrest protesters after all, putting them in zip-tie handcuffs and taking several tents down. The state police said that 102 protesters who had refused to leave were arrested and would be charged with trespassing and disorderly conduct. Ms. Nayul said Northeastern had made the decision to have the protesters arrested after the demonstration was infiltrated by professional organizers. She also said that someone in the protest had said, "Kill the Jews," the night before. Protesters denied both claims. A video appeared to show that it was a pro-Israel counter-protester who used the phrase as part of his criticism of the protesters' chants. In response to that video, Ms. Nayul said that any suggestion that repulsive anti-Semitic comments are sometimes acceptable depending on the context is reprehensible. The mass arrest at Northeastern was the second early morning crackdown on protesters at a Boston campus in less than a week. Early on Thursday, city police officers had stormed a student encampment in an alleyway at Emerson, a small private college downtown, ripping down tents and throwing students who had formed a barricade and refused to leave to the ground. The police arrested 118 people there, infuriating some students who said that the university had failed to protect them. But city officials defended the operation, saying it was necessary to clear the alley, which includes a public right-of-way. The issue was just around fire hazards that were being created with the tents, and the public health and safety risks that were happening there as well, Boston's mayor, Michelle Wu, told WCVB-TV. Pro-Palestinian encampments on college campuses have swiftly multiplied since Columbia University students launched theirs this month. They have at times drawn ire from students and faculty who complain about what they see as anti-Semitic chants and a lack of safety for Jewish students, and off campus from supporters of Israel's military operation in Gaza. So far, more than 34,000 Palestinians have died during the Israeli bombardment and invasion of Gaza, a response to an attack led by Hamas on October 7th, in which 1,200 Israelis were killed and about 250 people were taken hostage. At Columbia, where the president was already under fire from Republicans in Congress, the administration took an aggressive approach at first, calling in the New York Police Department, which arrested more than 100 people and removed tents. But students quickly returned, pitching new tents and vowing to stay. This time, rather than calling the police again, Columbia officials are negotiating with the protesters. "We called on NYPD to clear an encampment once, but we all share the view, based on discussions within our community and with outside experts, that to bring back the NYPD at this time would be counterproductive, further inflaming what is happening on campus and drawing thousands to our doorstep who would threaten our community," Columbia leaders said in a campus message on Friday night. "Having said that, we also need to continue to enforce our own rules. and ensure that those who violate the norms of our community face consequences. But at Emory, where the police arrested students and faculty members on Thursday, the university's president, Gregory Fenves, said flatly afterward that the institution would not tolerate vandalism, violence, or any attempt to disrupt our campus through the construction of encampments. Harvard has tried a different approach. The university restricted access to its historic Harvard Yard, allowing in only those who showed a university ID, and suspended a pro-Palestinian group, saying that it had held an authorized demonstration. The group and its supporters set up an encampment in the yard nonetheless. On Saturday, Harvard's dean of students sent an email to the student body warning that anyone participating in the encampment faced discipline. But there was no sign of any impending police operation, and the mood at the site during the day was lively and cheerful. Three Palestinian flags were raised above a statue of John Harvard. Saturday evening, the police and university staff members took them down. So that's just a dip into what's been happening on college campuses in protesting the war in Gaza. We'll turn our attention on this next article, which is titled, How Abrupt U-Turns Are Defining U.S. Environmental Regulations. The polarization of politics means that rules are imposed, gutted, and restored with each election. Experts say that's bad for the economy. The Biden administration's move on Thursday to strictly limit pollution from coal-burning power plants is a major policy shift. But in many ways, it's one more hairpin turn in a zigzag approach to environmental regulation in the United States, a pattern that has grown more extreme as the political landscape has become more polarized. Nearly a decade ago, President Barack Obama was the Democrat who tried to force power plants to stop burning coal, the dirtiest of the fossil fuels. His Republican successor, Donald Trump, effectively reversed that plan. Now, President Biden is trying once more to put an end to carbon emissions from coal plants. But Mr. Trump, who is running to replace Mr. Biden, has promised that he will again delete those plans if he wins in November. The country's participation in the Paris Climate Accord has followed the same swerving path. Under Mr. Obama, the United States joined the global commitment to fight climate change, only for Mr. Trump to pull the U.S. out of it, and for Mr. Biden to rejoin. If Mr. Trump wins the presidency, he is likely to exit the accord again. Government policies have always shifted between Democratic and Republican administrations, but they have generally stayed in place and have been tightened or loosened along a spectrum, depending on the occupant of the White House. But in the last decade, environmental rules in particular have been caught in a cycle of erase and replace whiplash. In the old days, the regulatory days of my youth, we were going back and forth between the 40-yard lines, said Douglas Holtz Eakin, who directed the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office and now runs the American Action Forum, a conservative research organization. Now it's back and forth between the 10-yard lines. They do it and undo it and do it and undo it. Economists and business executives say this new era of sharp switchbacks makes it difficult for industries to plan. If there is anything that companies like less than government regulation, it is an unstable business climate. If the regulatory changes are just whiplash or snapback, it creates a level of uncertainty that makes it very hard to build a vibrant economy, said Marty Durbin, Senior Vice President for Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the nation's largest business lobby. It's not about the specific regulation or the specific candidate, Mr. Durbin said. We've got to have more long-term certainty about how business is going to be regulated. The hairpin turns can lead to lost investments, said Mr. Holtz Eakin, as companies pay to comply with one rule, for example, by shutting down coal plants or building new electric vehicle factories, and end up with sunk costs as the rules are rolled back, only for the rules to be restored 4 years later, often with new details, timelines, and technical requirements. Change is costly, Mr. Holtz Eakin said. Even deregulation carries a cost. Doing and undoing these rules four times means four times the cost. He estimated the cost of the whiplash to the economy to be at easily billions and billions of dollars. The cycle of enacting and erasing environmental rules limits their capacity to protect the environment, Mr. Holtz Eakin said. In the past 4 months, the Biden administration has strengthened or restored rules that Mr. Trump had deleted, including regulations to cut greenhouse emissions from cars and oil and gas wells, to limit the pollution of toxic coal ash, to protect the habitat of the sage grouse and other endangered species, and to tighten safety controls at chemical plants. All of these rules are likely to be weakened or rolled back once again under a new Trump administration. Mr. Biden has made those actions a hallmark of his administration from his first day in office. On that day, he rescinded the permit for the Keystone XL oil pipeline, which Mr. Obama had rejected but Mr. Trump had later revived. Mr. Biden also ordered federal agencies to review and reinstate more than 100 environmental regulations that Mr. Trump had watered down or removed. We're going to combat climate change in a way we have not before, Mr. Biden said on that day, calling for a whole-of-government approach in which agencies across the federal government, from the USDA to the Pentagon, enact policies to address global warming. The escalation of climate change as a defining crisis of the century has made it a highly visible target for Mr. Trump, who has called global warming a hoax. He has promised to promote fossil fuels and destroy regulations designed to limit their emissions, which are dangerously heating the planet. A nearly 1,000-page battle plan for the first 180 days of a new Republican administration, written in part by former senior energy and environmental officials from the former Trump administration, targets multitudes of environmental rules for rollback. It also pointedly sums up an overarching philosophy. The Biden administration's climate fanaticism will need a whole-of-government unwinding. Some economists have sought to measure the economic impacts of climate regulation whiplash. So, wow, you know, the changing of our direction of our country with environmental concerns continues to be on a rocky slope. Our next article takes us to South Africa with these intro facts. 30 years ago, the South African miracle came true. Millions voted in the country's first democratic elections, seemingly delivering a death blow to apartheid. The African National Congress rose to power under the leadership of Nelson Mandela and used the Freedom Charter, a decades-old manifesto, as a guide to forming a new nation. The Charter's 10 declarations offered a vision for overcoming apartheid through a free, multiracial society with quality housing, education, and economic opportunities for all. As South Africans celebrate 30 years of freedom and prepare to vote in a pivotal national election, we looked at how far the country has come in meeting the Freedom Charter's goals. And this article is titled, Has South Africa Truly Defeated Apartheid? When the apartheid government was toppled in South Africa, ending white minority rule, people around the world shared in the excitement and optimism that a more just society would emerge. A generation later, the country's journey provides a broader lesson. It is far easier to rally for an end to racism than it is to undo entrenched inequities and to govern a complicated country. The African National Congress won the 1994 election on the promise of a better life for all. But for many, that promise has fallen short. Polls now suggest that in the election scheduled for May 29th, the party risks losing its absolute majority in the national government for the first time. No one doubts that South Africa has made strides since the days of legalized racial oppression. Democracy has brought a growing black middle class, access to better education across racial lines, and a basic human dignity once stolen from the black majority. But there also has been a widening gap between rich and poor, a breakdown in basic services like electricity and water, and continued isolation of Black families stuck in ramshackle homes in distant communities. Black South Africans, who make up 81% of the population, often argue that they've gained political freedom, but not economic freedom, and remain trapped in the structure of apartheid. We went through the Freedom Charter's declarations, each ending in an exclamation point, to measure South Africa's progress and shortcomings over the past 30 years. The ideal, the people shall govern. The reality, democracy is stable, but South Africans are disillusioned and most no longer vote. And voter turnout from 1994, which was 86% of the voting population, fell in 2019 to 49%. On a continent where coups, autocrats, and flawed elections have become common, South Africa is a widely admired exception. Since 1994, the country has held national elections every 5 years, with local elections in between. Presidents have changed, but the party in power, the ANC, never has. Despite this, there have never been any serious doubts about the integrity of those electoral contests. A record 52 parties will compete in the national election this year. Despite the electoral stability, politics have been dangerous. Fierce conflict within the ANC has resulted in many assassinations over the years. The ANC's access to state resources as the governing party has fueled many of the disputes and led to widespread corruption, from top national officials down to local councillors. The enrichment of ANC leaders, while many people barely earn enough to feed themselves, has shaken the faith of many South Africans in their democratic system. Last year, 22% of South Africans approved of the functioning of the country's democracy, down from 63% in 2004, according to surveys from the Human Sciences Research Council. The ideal: all national groups shall have equal rights. The reality: society is free and equal on paper, but economic barriers endure. Under apartheid, race restricted every aspect of life for South Africans who were Black, Indian, and colored, a multiracial classification created by the government. There were strict limits on where they could live, attend school, work, and travel. Laws enforced this segregation, and partaking in politics was criminalized. But the democratic government drafted a constitution that enshrined equal rights for all. South Africa has become a place where people of all races often dine, worship, and party together. Gay rights are largely accepted. There is a free and vigorous press, and protests and open political debate are a part of life. But many of the economic barriers created under apartheid still endure. By one measure, the World Bank has ranked South Africa as the most unequal country in the world. 10% of the population holds about 71% of the country's wealth, while the bottom 60% holds just 7% of assets, according to the World Bank. To a large extent, the wealth disparities have kept millions of black South Africans relegated to some of the most deplorable conditions. Just look at the place in the Soweto community of Kliptown, where hundreds of anti-apartheid activists gathered to draft the Freedom Charter in 1955. It is now known as Walter Sisulu Square, named for a prominent anti-apartheid activist. Nearly two decades ago, the government built a large concrete complex around the square with restaurants, offices, and a hotel. But because of a lack of maintenance and huge riots in 2021 that stemmed from political grievances, most of the businesses are now gutted, littered, and stinking of sewage. Informal traders eke out a living nearby, selling sandwiches, clothes, and fruit. Across adjacent railroad tracks sits an all-black neighborhood where most residents live in tin shacks, use outdoor latrines, rely on jury-rigged wires for electricity, and navigate craggy dirt roads. The ideal: the people shall share in the country's wealth. The reality: a wide economic gulf persists between black and white South Africans. The black middle and upper classes have grown significantly. In 1995, just 350,000 black South Africans lived in households that were among the top 15% in income, according to researchers at the University of Cape Town's Liberty Institute of Strategic Marketing. By 2022, that number had grown to about 5.6 million. Still, black families are underrepresented among rich households. Many expected something better for this far into democracy. Much of the nation's wealth remains in white hands. Black South Africans had a stake in only 29% of the companies listed on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, according to a 2022 report by South Africa's Black Economic Empowerment Commission. Not a single entity on the exchange was fully black-owned, the report said. Economists say the country's economy never took off enough to allow for a greater redistribution of wealth. Even when South Africa experienced its strongest stretch of economic growth in the first decade and a half of democracy, it still lagged behind its peers in Africa and other upper-middle-income countries. Since then, growth has been tepid, and contraction since the COVID-19 pandemic has been sharper than that in similarly sized economies. Government rules have allowed black South Africans to gain a greater stake in industries like mining, where black ownership has grown from 2% to 39% over the past two decades. But the gains have gone to relatively few people at the top. However, the Bafokeng Kingdom, an ethnic group within South Africa, has shown what is possible when a community gets its fair share of its resource wealth. The kingdom sits on rich platinum deposits. After a court victory in 1999 that affirmed its land rights, the kingdom used its platinum dividends to build a school with a large campus and a modern clinic, and to invest in other industries. Most families live in large brick homes that are the envy of other rural villages. And we'll have time for one more statement from their charter. The ideal, the land shall be shared among those who work it. The reality, white South Africans continue to own most of the land. At the end of apartheid, when almost all of South Africa's agricultural land was white-owned, Mr. Mandela's government pledged in 1994 to transfer 30% of it into black hands within a few years, by encouraging white landowners to sell. The government failed to meet its goal, and it stretched the deadline to 2030. So far, about 25% of white-owned farmland has been transferred to black ownership, mostly through the purchase of land by the government or black individuals, according to Wandile Shilobo and Johan Kirsten, agricultural economists at Stellenbosch University. White South Africans make up roughly 7% of the population, but white-owned farms still cover about half of the country's entire surface area, according to Mr. Silobo and Mr. Kirsten. In the first decade of democracy, the government gave black people full ownership of the white-owned farms it had bought. Owning the land meant that black families had the chance not only to feed and support themselves, but also to advance. But the government is no longer giving land to black South Africans outright, offering long-term leases instead, Mr. Silobo and Mr. Kirsten said. Without ownership, black farmers cannot generate wealth by using the land as collateral to get a bank loan. That has prevented black farmers from expanding their operations to be commercially competitive. Only about 7% of commercial-scale farms, those that sell to major grocers or export their products, are black-owned. Only about 10% of the food produced by commercial farms in South Africa comes from black-owned farms, about the same share as in the 1980s, Mr. Silobo said. In the first decade of democracy, more than 930,000 mostly black and colored farm workers were evicted from farms despite new laws intended to allow them to spend their lives on the farms where they worked. We haven't been able to live up to those ideals of black land ownership, Mr. Silobo said. So, interesting look at South Africa 30 years ago and today. We'll come to the United States for this next article, and it involves somebody from our own community. This article is titled, A Match Made in MAGA, How a Friendship Helped J.D. Vance Land on Trump's VP List. It was just 43 days before the 2022 Republican primary in Ohio, and former President Donald Trump had yet to throw his weight behind a Senate candidate. J.D. Vance, a political novice competing in a packed field, had a huge problem. He had publicly called Mr. Trump loathsome and an idiot. Once, he described him as cultural heroin. Then came an unexpected lifeline. Enough with the lies being told about this guy, Donald Trump Jr., the former president's son, wrote on Twitter, assuring his followers that Mr. Vance had become a fan of his father. A month later, encouraged by his son, the elder Mr. Trump endorsed Mr. Vance. Today, Mr. Vance is one of the former president's most reliable allies and a leader of a band of Republicans pushing Senate Republicans to the right. And his star has only continued to rise. Mr. Vance is on the list of Mr. Trump's possible running mates, according to two people familiar with the discussions. In no small part, Mr. Vance owes his quick ascent into the Trump orbit to his unlikely friendship and ideological kinship with the former president's oldest son. They text or talk nearly daily and try to meet up if they are in the same city, according to people who know them both. They are a social media tag team, often reposting each other's messages. Although he has stressed that the choice of a running mate is his father's decision alone, Mr. Trump has said he would be happy with Mr. Vance on the GOP ticket. The friendship is among the MAGA movement's more unusual pairings. Mr. Vance, 39, is a self-made man who had a fatherless childhood. Mr. Trump, 46, has been at the right hand of his billionaire father his whole life. Mr. Vance is wonky and well-spoken, a Yale Law School graduate and memoirist regarded as an intellectual standard-bearer for Trumpism. The former president's son is sarcastic and foul-mouthed, a sharper reader of people than of policy papers, and a political weather vane for his father. But the men share right-wing nationalist politics and a vision for how the Republican Party should root out vestiges of old elites. In some ways, they represent the ego and the id of the MAGA movement and, some Republican strategists argue, its next wave of insurgency. Kevin Roberts, the president of the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, said that for voters seeking a next-generation leader, there was virtually no one like Senator Vance. Those same voters look up to Donald Trump Jr., he said. They know both men. Mr. Vance declined to be interviewed for this article. The younger Mr. Trump said in a statement, "In the world of politics, you make a lot of acquaintances, but there are very few actual friends. J.D. has become a close friend of mine, and I'm a big supporter of everything he's been doing policy-wise to put America first in the Senate." As the former president narrows his lists of running mates with his eldest son as an informal advisor, personal loyalty is surely a factor. Mr. Trump has insisted that his former vice president, Mike Pence, betrayed him by refusing to allow him and his allies to manipulate the results of the 2020 election in his favor. Mr. Vance has made clear that he is no Mr. Pence. He has claimed that the 2020 election was blighted by widespread fraud, an allegation that has been repeatedly and thoroughly debunked. He told ABC News this February that had he been vice president in January 2021, he would have allowed Congress to consider fraudulent slates of pro-Trump electors before certifying the election, a scheme meant to disrupt the transfer of power after Joseph Biden won the presidency. Mr. Vance's allegiance to the former president is relatively new, but friends say it is deep. In his memoir, Mr. Vance wrote that his upbringing taught him to value loyalty, honor, and toughness. The former president helped him edge out his primary opponents when he could have stood aside. The senator is an intensely, personally loyal guy, said Luke Thompson, a close friend who ran the super PAC that backed Mr. Vance's campaign. It is hard to overstate the gap in backgrounds between Mr. Vance and Donald Trump Jr. Mr. Vance grew up in Middletown, Ohio, a steel mill town, and moved 6 times in as many years before his grandmother took him in as a teenager. Mr. Vance's name tracks his childhood upheaval. He was born James Donald Bowman after his father, Daniel Bowman, who surrendered him for adoption when he was 6. His mother, who battled drug addiction for years, renamed him James David Hamill, erasing his father's names and substituting the surname of his stepfather, one in a string of fast disappearing father figures. Mr. Vance later adopted his grandmother's surname. Mr. Vance wrote that his mother once threatened to crash their car and kill them both. He watched as she was driven away in handcuffs in the back of a police car. I have never felt so lonely, he wrote in his book, Hillbilly Elegy, a memoir of a family and a culture in crisis. Mr. Trump's home was a luxury apartment at the top of Manhattan Tower with his father's name on it. In his memoir, Triggered, How the Left Thrives on Hate and Wants to Silence Us, he recounted how his mother, Ivana Trump, tried to order a glass of Chardonnay at a Taco Bell when dropping him off at boarding school in a small Pennsylvania town. News of the incident spread to his new schoolmates. Really awesome, Mom. Thanks, he wrote. Politically, they were also far apart, even as late as 2017. Mr. Trump was one of his father's most tireless cheerleaders in his first run for president. Echoing his father's hardline rhetoric and relishing every opportunity to slam liberals. Mr. Vance was a former Marine, a venture capitalist, and a conservative Republican who was appalled by candidate Trump. In early 2016, he texted a former Yale roommate that he feared Mr. Trump could be America's Hitler. Publicly, he said that Mr. Trump's policy proposals range from immoral to absurd. He voted for an independent candidate for president. After Mr. Trump's victory, pundits celebrated Mr. Vance's book as a key to understanding the discontent of white working-class voters who had swung the election. Mr. Vance became an overnight media celebrity. In those days, he held up former President Barack Obama, who also grew up fatherless, as a role model. Mr. Obama was someone whose history looked something like mine, but whose future contained something I wanted, he wrote in a New York Times opinion essay in January 2017. But Mr. Vance's memoir also reveals his pragmatic approach to self-advancement. He wanted to finish college faster, so he doubled his course load. Because the parents of rich kids in his hometown were either lawyers or doctors, he wrote, he went to law school. To get X, do Y. In a Time magazine interview shortly after he announced his Senate run in July 2021, Mr. Vance acknowledged a similar calculus in his conversion from a never-Trumper to a Trump admirer. Mr. Trump is the leader of this movement, he said then, and if I actually care about these people and the things I say I care about, I need to just suck it up and support him. Mr. Vance deleted his anti-Trump tweets. He became a regular figure on Tucker Carlson's show on Fox News, of which the former president was an avid viewer. He hired an advisor to Donald Trump Jr. to help run his campaign. He began working through intermediaries to lobby the former president for an endorsement. One of the first was Charlie Kirk, a young activist who carried Donald Trump Jr.'s bags and booked his flights during the 2016 campaign. Mr. Kirk's group, Turning Point USA, had since built up an impressive following of Republican conservatives. In early 2021, Mr. Kirk texted an advisor to Donald Trump Jr. about Mr. Vance's political promise, according to a person familiar with the exchange. Mr. Trump's response was encouraging. He had read Hillbilly Elegy, he said, and he loved it. That March, Mr. Vance made a pilgrimage to Mar-a-Lago, the former president's private club in Palm Beach, Florida, to seek his endorsement. Donald Trump Jr. also attended the meeting, as did Peter Thiel, the Silicon Valley billionaire who was bankrolling Mr. Vance's campaign. Mr. Vance did not get what he wanted, but he left hopeful that the elder Mr. Trump would at least keep an eye on his race. Mr. Vance was good-looking, the former president later noted, according to people familiar with Mr. Trump's reaction. But his opponents were clobbering Mr. Vance with his previous anti-Trump remarks. Donald Trump Jr. was not put off by Mr. Vance's U-turn. Guess who else didn't like Trump in 2016? Everybody, he said later. Mr. Vance was at least consistent and intellectually honest about why, he said. People close to both men said that their friendship blossomed after Mr. Vance joined the Senate in January 2023. Since then, the public signs of their mutual appreciation have been frequent. Mr. Trump often praises Mr. Vance on social media and on his podcast on Rumble, a right-leaning social media site. Mr. Vance's venture capital firm has invested in the platform. "We need every GOP senator to be at J.D. Vance 1," Mr. Trump wrote last December. Indeed, Mr. Vance is both an energetic, vocal ally to the former president and one of the leaders of a bloc of roughly a dozen Republican senators who have tried to push the Senate in a more isolationist and Trumpist direction, often clashing with Senator Mitch McConnell, the minority leader. Mr. Vance worked hard, though unsuccessfully, to stop a $60 billion aid package for Ukraine's war against Russia's invasion. For 10 months, he has blocked Biden administration nominees to top Justice Department posts to protest Mr. Trump's felony indictment on charges of mishandling classified documents. So that's an interesting article looking at the relationship of our local statewide leader and the possible presidency coming in. We'll see how that evolves. This is Beth Brand. Thank you for listening, and I wish you a wonderful week ahead.